Thanks, members, for coming a little early. The Senate File 2448 is the first bill up, and that is my bill. We're going to take a little bit of testimony on that. But what Senate File 2448 does, members, is basically freeze LGA payments for 2013 at the 2012 level so that we can provide the certainty that we've been promising our local partners that the LGA payments would neither go up or down from 2010 going forward. And so this would mean that the payments are the same in 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2013. What we don't want is for the formula adjustments to change the certified levy amount. We just want to keep everything the same so folks know what to expect with their 2013 payments. And we have a spreadsheet for members that will talk about what some of those slight adjustments might otherwise have meant. And we also have Jack Paulson here who can describe for us the formula and what's been happening with the formula. And so, Mr. Paulson, if you would join us at the table. Members, you should have the spreadsheet. It says projected 2013 local government aid compared to 2012 certified LGA. Mr. Paulson, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jack Paulson from Senate Council on Research. As the Chair mentioned, we have, as a staff, we did a simulation of what the 2013 local government aid distribution will look like under current law. If you look at it, you'll see that there are a lot of negatives and a number of fairly significant swings in aid, and I'll talk a little bit about what we see based on the formula. What's happening is that about 242 cities are currently on the LGA formula. It's about 28%. 20 cities have their increases capped, and 591 cities are at their minimum aid. That's about 69% of the total. As far as why that's going on, as the Chair mentioned, aid has been, since 2010, aid has been relatively constant. The aid for 2011 and 2012 was based on the 2010 aid after an allotments and legislative reductions. One of the features of the 2010 allotment was that cities under 1,000 population did not receive a reduction, and that has carried through, and that is affecting the distribution to some extent still. So those are some of the things that are going on. Another factor is the conversion of the market value homestead credit to an exclusion. That reduced the values of cities, and that had, for each city, that reduces their value, but also in the aggregate, it changes the tax effort rate that's used in the formula. And so the effort rate is going from 38% to 45%. That's on the revenue-raising side. On the need side, the percent of housing built before 1940 is updated for the census. And that is, for the first time since 2003, that is changing the need factor for a number of cities. And also all the rest of the need factors, the accident factor, the various other things that go into the need formula, have changed over the 3 years. So if you look at, there are some examples of, pick out the city of Anoka for one that's on the first page. They have a significant jump in aid. There's two things going on there, really. Part of their need is based on a 10-year reduction in population, and when the census figures are used, it gives them a significant increase as compared to what the estimates were used prior to that. One other point I'll make is that if you look at Anoka, their certified 2012 aid is $901,000, and it's going up to $1,491,000. But this is kind of a snapshot. If you go back to what they were certified in 2011, it was $1,771,000. So sometimes with a longer view, you can see a big jump in a particular year. But if you go back to earlier times, it doesn't stand out as much. The same applies to Circle Pines and St. Francis, or a couple other examples where it looks like a big percentage increase, but if you look back to where they were a couple of years ago, what's happened is that their aid reduction based on levy plus aid was a large reduction for them, and so it brings down their aid for 2012. Historically, they were at a higher level than that.
Mr. Paulson, questions for Mr. Paulson? One of the second reasons, members, for working on this freeze is that we have underway an LGA working group, and Senator Chamberlain is the chair of that LGA working group, and he can comment about the progress and maybe provide an update of what's happening with that group. Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair and members, we're scheduled to meet, I think, next week. I have to check the calendar, but as always, we've reviewed the studies and reports over the last, as you know, several decades, and the conclusions usually have all been the same, defining need. And, most of the members on the commission and the task force agree that we have to work on the need formula and what that means. When you speak of need and try to define it, everybody has a need, and it cannot be changed. But we are working on trying to finally fine-tune that after all these years of looking at that need formula and what defines need, and get down to something that would be more purposeful for the cities, both rural and urban. So we'll be meeting again in the next week or so.
Senator Chamberlain, do you expect some recommendations for LGA coming out of that group and for us for the next legislative session?
Madam Chair, members, yes, I do. That is our goal in the next couple weeks, to have decide where we're going to go with that.
Okay. And members, in light of the fact that we're undertaking a big review and we'll be looking at making recommendations for a longer-term adjustment, I think it makes a lot of sense to maintain things the way they are until those recommendations are brought forward, and then we can see how they might impact communities and see if we can adopt some major revisions to the program. So other questions or comments? Senator Howe.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's good. I'd certainly want to work with Senator Chamberlain. I think there's some limitations. We should have some. I'm sure you've heard me speak before about what LGA should be used for, and I think it should be used for essential services, and I'd like us to go towards that. But I am concerned on some of these cities and some of the changes. One in particular, I look at Goodview, and their proposed change was 267%, and I'm sure they were looking at that. But that's a pretty significant difference, over $100,000 for a very, what I would call a smaller size, or community to deal with. And so I know they have concerns about that, but I also understand the financial situation we're in, and I also understand that we need to let the working group work through this.
Yeah, and Senator Howe, I would add that when there are cities that look to perhaps getting an increase, and there are cities that look to getting a decrease as a result. And so it seems to me the best approach here is to maintain status quo, which has been essentially the status quo for a couple of years, while we sort out these major changes. Senator Chamberlain, did you have other comments about the LGA working group or about the proposed freeze here?
Madam Chair, members, I would agree with your assessment that until, as you all know, it's a fairly large and complicated process, and it's really a house of cards. If you pull one piece out, the whole thing will come down. So we want to make sure we do it methodically and properly and correctly, because there are some folks out in the rural areas that have legitimate concerns. And I would agree with your assessment that we should wait, hold this, freeze it, so they get something, and wait until we get some final recommendations so we can go at it more methodically and logically.
Thank you. Are there folks here that would like to testify one way or the other on the LGA freeze? Thank you, Mr. Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson, welcome back.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for taking the time to consider a few points. First of all, let me say the League of Cities has no policy specific for or against a freeze in the LGA formula. Really, our policies have been rooted in support for a functioning formula. I think over the years we've realized that a formula that functions is a more defensible formula. That said, I think we understand that, and we do strongly support the working group that Senators Hoffman, Senator Scoy, and Senator Chamberlain are all serving on, and we are working with them to try to come up with a system that will be more functioning, will be more defensible, and will allow us potentially to put more money into that LGA system. So, again, we don't have any specific policy position on this, but I wanted to indicate our support for the working group. And let me just say that, you know, if you look at this printout that Mr. Paulson has presented, you can see that there are about 600 cities that would lose under the functioning formula, would gain under a freeze, about 120 cities that are the reverse because of the freeze, they'll lose, and about 110 cities that are essentially frozen. I just want to make that point. And then finally, I did talk with Senator Howe about the concept of if you could find some extra money for a transition period, you could allow part of the formula to function if you had about $12 million to allow the 2013 distribution to increase for those cities that would otherwise receive an increase. I understand that money is difficult to find right now, but it would cost about $12 million to give cities the greater of their 2013 or their 2012 amounts. With that, Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Madam Chair.
Carlson, Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, do you have any ideas of where that $12 million could come from?
That's the question of the hour, Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, by freezing the formula, we are saving about $1.2 million in what was booked as the cost of the LGA formula for 2013. So that brings us down to about, $11 million, I suppose, of additional money we would have to find. I'll be very honest with you, Senator. I haven't thought of any exact way to do that. Obviously, we'd need to make this fiscally neutral. So I will continue to look at options for ways to accomplish that outcome to help Goodview and a few other cities with the reduction that would occur under the freeze. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Peterson here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. The Coalition's first priority this year, of course, was to restore some of the reductions that have happened since 2008. However, if that is not in the cards, we are also support the idea that Mr. Carlson just spoke of allowing cities to either have the higher of their formula of 2013 or the frozen 2012 amount. Which they are actually doing in the House Omnibus Tax Bill for cities under 5,000. If that is not possible, most of our cities do benefit from the freeze and do support the idea of freezing their LGA so we don't see the big changes from year to year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Ms. Nauman, welcome back.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, Patricia Nauman, Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I just want to echo essentially what Mr. Carlson said. We don't have a policy on the freeze, but we do support a functioning, workable formula, and also changes to the LGA program and reforms that help to reduce the volatility. And I think that would include trying to reduce the number of changes that are made to this program from year to year so that our cities have an expectation of what they're going to receive.
Ms. Nauman, as you know, I couldn't agree more, and I hope the three of you are very actively engaged in the conversations with that LGA working groups. Good. Thanks. Good to hear. Other questions or comments from folks that would like to testify, perhaps one way or the other? Seeing none, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion, Senate File 2448. Senator Chamberlain, Senate File 2404 is modifying the requirements for the estate tax. Senator Chamberlain, I think this is the first time we've seen the revenue note on this. Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, I don't always bring things here that appear to cost a lot of money. We have here, last year, as you recall, Senator Benson, I believe, made some adjustments to the estate tax law in the state. I don't remember all the details of those adjustments, but what this does is, as many of you know, in our state, We have a three-year requirement for property to be held before the exemption, the estate tax exemption, can be claimed. So what this bill does is eliminates the three-year holding period to get the exemption. So essentially, if you've got the property and you have you're a small business owner, you have this property, and you qualify as a small business owner or farm property, then you're not required to have the three-year hold the property for 3 years to get that exemption. And this is primarily aimed at accidental and unexpected deaths, as well as situations and cases of divorce. The fiscal note itself, I'll let Mr. Hickey talk in a minute here. The fiscal note itself is is up there a bit. We would expect it not to be that high for various reasons, but I'll let Mr. Hickey explain that more. So just in short, this is just eliminates a three-year exemption on of holding property for 3 years before you can claim the exemption on qualified business, small business property or farm property. And Mr. Hickey?
Welcome, Mr. Hickey. And I'm also going to ask that someone from the Department of Revenue, if they can, Ms. Von Mosch, maybe testify about the revenue note. But Mr. Hickey.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward today. We're the group, we're probably one of the groups most affected by this. We represent 12,000 small businesses and farmers across Minnesota. And I just wanted to mention my letter, didn't get you the most recent version in your handout, but the Minnesota Farmers Union, Minnesota Farmers Bureau, and the Minnesota CPAs also support this legislation. Senator Ortman, I just want to thank you once again for your efforts last year to get this important law passed. We wouldn't be here having this discussion today if that hadn't occurred. So thanks again. That was a major step forward for family-held businesses and farms. On the estate tax, the biggest motivation for this bill is to try to deal with situations where people may miss the exemption, I think most likely due to divorce or being single. The statute says that the decedent or the decedent's spouse must have been materially involved. And if you're single or if you're divorced, you don't have that spouse. And so the concern is that somebody dies unexpectedly who's divorced or single, and the family misses the exemption, which is so important to them to keep the small business and the farm going. If you have a spouse, it's very unlikely you're both going to unexpectedly pass at the same time, although I guess, you know, something like a tragic airline accident or car accident could occur. But, you know, I think the bigger problem is going to be when it's a divorced or single person and they don't have you can't substitute a son or daughter for spouse the way our law is read, and we just passed it, and obviously it might be a work in progress going forward. We are very concerned about the fiscal note. In my handout, I just cited two of the key provisions in item four, if you can find it, that one, the decedent or the spouse must have been materially involved, and possibly somebody from the department or council can give us a little more information on that based on section 469 of the IRS code. But I'm pretty sure that does not include wealthy father, wealthy mother, grandfather. They're not materially involved to the meeting the IRS definition of what that means. Second, it goes on to say the law also states property does not consist of cash or cash equivalents. And so, you know, it's only so much property you can give somebody. There's only so much property, non-cash property, you can even utilize. And so those are our concerns about the fiscal note. It very came very late. You'll have to apologize for my handout talking about their previous fiscal note, which said they couldn't determine. And so I could not redo this handout last night and get a new version to you. So I just want to point out that inaccuracy. But so we're very concerned about the fiscal note. Importantly, this bill keeps the three-year hold period after the assets have been transferred, and it keeps the recapture tax at a very high rate. The maximum rate allowed under Minnesota state tax law is 16%. So there's a lot of safeguards in here. Quite baffled by the fiscal note, but just appreciate your consideration of this, and possibly there's another option, a one-year rule, or possibly Another idea for a bill was if somebody expanded their business and farm, and the original farm and business did make the three-year rule, but the expansion, they died suddenly before 3 years since the expansion occurred, because the expansion could really be critical to that business or farm. And to tell the heirs, you don't get the expansion, you only get the original piece of property. And so there's several different things we could look at, but thanks for the time and consideration today.
Well, Mr. Hickey and Senator Chamberlain, I hope you'll consider that maybe a one-year hold back might have a very big impact on the fiscal note or the revenue note. Ms. Von Mosch, if you can join us. In particular, I'm concerned about the analysis detail. It says that as of yet, no data is available regarding how often the deduction of qualified small business property and qualified farm property will occur. If that's the case, I think it's pretty hard to then give us a revenue note that says in 2015 it's going to cost $45 million. I don't know where you've extrapolated that information from, so maybe you can advise us.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Susan Von Mosch with the Department of Revenue. The portion that you were reading was in the first bullet under the revenue analysis detail. The next bullet does talk about the elimination of the three-year ownership requirement would likely make the deduction, the estate tax deduction, available to a greater number of estates. And to do this analysis, the Department of Revenue uses our estate tax database, which contains returns going from 2008. And so that is the basis of the analysis. And then if you go to the second page, the assumptions used in this are that the average extra deduction from the taxable estate would be about $2 million, but it could go as high as $4 million. Further down the page, the assumption is that it would reduce the estate taxes collected. This further modification would reduce the estate tax collection. Estate taxes collected by about 63% of the average. And then in the bullet below that, there is a further adjustment made because of the law that passed last year in 2011 is not yet fully incorporated into the database, and so that assumes a reduction of 42%. And so you get these assumptions that are made, we are making assumptions without knowing how many people are actually going to be using this because the law has not been in effect long enough to actually have people filing. And then the reason that the fiscal year 2013 estimate is so low is just because of the phase-in in terms of when it would be effective. And if it is effective on the day after death, typically the paperwork is filed 9 months later. So we just get a very small amount that would be in the fiscal year 13. Another part of this assumption that is highlighted on the first page is just the fact that when this becomes available, there would be a high level of estate planning activity that would take place, making sure that people are aware of this this new deduction. So that is basically the foundation of the revenue estimate.
Ms. Von Mosch, I think it would have been more honest here to say you don't know than to have all these likelies and assumptions and guesses. And this is a frustrating revenue note for me to look at. I'll be honest. It doesn't give me any real comfort that you have real solid basis for making that extrapolation of $45 million in 2015. And I would say maybe the most important note is the one on the back at the top where it says, since tax planning practitioners are involved in state tax planning, it is likely that significant use will be made of the opportunity to create small business or farm operations shortly before death in order to take advantage of the small business and farm deduction. And I think that if that's the case, then a 1 year would alleviate that. And I hope that Senator Chamberlain and Mr. Hickey would look at maybe having that 1 year hold back. If that's what you don't like, I'd prefer that the Department of Revenue just say, we don't know, but we don't like this provision, and we think that there will be a major impact with tax practitioners if they're looking at this. But I don't have any confidence at all in your numbers, I'll be honest. Maybe others have comments. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm glad you raised that first bullet point. That's what I honed on the revenue note. I was wondering where, if anyone can remind us, I don't remember who the chief author of this original proposal was. It you? Okay.
Yes.
So where did the 3 years come from, and what was the idea behind the
3 years? Senator Dibble, I believe that's a federal 3-year holdback. Okay. In the federal. But I could be wrong about that. Maybe Ms. Von Mosch knows. But I think the looking at the 3-year to the 1-year, Ms. Von Mosch, it would have helped maybe to look. I know you said you were looking at the 2008 estates. It'd be nice to know how much estate planning was done in that last year. For those 2008 estates, do you know that?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question.
Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, I know that in 2010, I was just looking at some notes. There were about 1,300 filers for estate tax. So that's where they collected. That was in 2010. So, you could extrapolate. I guess if you went out to 2015, and there was about $150 million collected, $145 million collected in that year, in 2010. In estate taxes, so I mean, it would probably go up a little bit, but that would almost be not quite a third of all the people that would be filing and collecting the estate tax. So that's all I have on that.
Madam Chair, I can check and get information on the information that's in the database that we're using.
I would appreciate that. I would appreciate your looking at this one more time and working with Senator Chamberlain and Mr. Hickey, and maybe the one-year look-back provision makes some sense, and maybe it will really impact this note and some of the assumptions that you've made here. I hope you'll do your best to work with them on this. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, we'll work with the author on this.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if Ms. Von Mosch could explain the fifth bullet point under the detailed analysis. Where it starts with the adjusting the reduction for the tax changes that were enacted previously in 2011 but not reflected in the 2008 estate tax database. The reduction in the estate tax after recalculation was about 42%.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, that would be the adjustment made for the enactment of this bill in 2011, because it's not in the 2008 database. So they used the revenue estimate that was done for the original bill on the small business and the farm qualifying, and that was the adjustment that was made for the bill as originally passed last year.
Thank you. Without objection, the chair would lay over Senate File 2404 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Senator Daley, Senate File 2427. Senator Daley, Ms. McQuay is also going to speak to the revenue estimate that we received on Senate File 2427. But Senator Daley, if you'd like to present your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chairwoman and members. And I do have the A1 amendment, if Senator Howe could move that.
We'll pass it out real quick first, Senator Howe, and then.
Madam Chair, if Senate Counsel could just briefly describe the changes that this will have.
We sure can. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment simply strikes language on page 2 of the bill, beginning at the end of line 19. The language at the end of line 19 through the middle of line 27 is now obsolete, and then we're deleting the new language beginning on line 2.27 through 2.31. And the reason is that we're simply just going to refer to the most updated version of the Internal Revenue Code, updated on February 14th, 2012.
So, Senator Howe would move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted. Senator Daley.
Madam Chair, if I could draw members' attention to the Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis note. It's a single page. It says SF number 2427, Individual Retirement Account Rollover Provisions Conformance. Members, this is really a conformity bill. And if you just look at this note, it very briefly and at a high level summarizes the key points. The bill conforms the Minnesota definition of net income to federal changes made in February 2012, and then there's a bunch of public law 112-95 and all that stuff. Eligible current and former airline employees were permitted to transfer to a Roth IRA up to 100% of certain payments received in connection with the airline's bankruptcy. Under the new federal law, eligible employees and their surviving spouses may transfer up to 90% of airline bankruptcy-related payments to a traditional IRA and claim a refund of the federal taxes they paid on such funds. So that's really the gist of what this is. Those employees who exercised the Roth IRA rollover opportunity prior to 2012 are also eligible to transfer up to 90% of those Roth IRA funds to a traditional IRA and claim a refund. So as I mentioned right at the outset, it's really a conformity measure so that Minnesota is in line with the federal, based on the February 2012 changes.
Thank you. Mr. Davidman, you're here to testify.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members for the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Davidman with Delta Airlines. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning for Senator Daley bringing this bill forward. I ask the committee's a little bit of patience. This is actually a provision that was brought forward by a number of our employees, especially our pilots. Our experts are today up in the air flying our customers and our passengers all around the country, so they couldn't be here today, so you get me to pinch hit. But I think Senator Daley did a nice job of describing what the bill does. What I wanted to do is just provide a little background of why we got to this point today. When pre-merger Northwest, as well as pre-merger Delta, United, U.S. Airways, were in bankruptcy around the 2005-2006 timeline, as they were exiting, this was a tool that the companies used to provide some compensation to the employees for going through the bankruptcy through what's called a bankruptcy claim or a note. That is the compensation we're talking about here. Senator Daley said it was permitted under federal law to be able to use a Roth IRA, but we've been trying to allow it for a traditional IRA as well. Unfortunately, the bill that was being carried in at the federal level was the FAA reauthorization bill, which had over 20 extensions over the last number of years. That bill finally passed earlier this year, and therefore that's why we're sitting in 2012 looking to try and amend tax returns from 2007. I believe under current law, there's a three-year statute of limitations to be able to do that. This provision would allow for a short window, I believe about 180 days, to go back in and amend those tax returns on behalf of our employees. So I just wanted to give a little background and can stand for any questions.
Members, questions or comments? Otherwise, Ms. McQuay, you wanted to comment on the fiscal or the revenue note?
Madam Chair and members, the note just reflects that in fiscal year 13, the $1.4 million reduction to the general fund is representative of the refunds that would go out. And going into the out years, that would just reflect the tax deferral of the rollovers from, or not the existing rollovers going into the out years.
Questions or comments?
Madam Chair, just to clarify the length of time, just to be clear, individual needs to place their funds into an IRA by August 13th, 2012, and then they have until the 15th of April, 2013, to file that amended return.
Mr. Davidman, is there a deadline by which Minnesota must conform in order to take advantage of this federal program?
I believe that the federal law requires for the same deadline that we're trying to put in law here, that it is also a short window of time to be able to amend your federal returns. So the only deadline would be if to be consistent with the federal deadline.
What I'm wondering is the overall legislation, was there a deadline there for taking action in Minnesota?
Not in Minnesota specific, just with the federal tax returns.
Ms. McQuay, do you know what I'm asking?
Madam Chair, I believe we have 3.5 years, or a taxpayer has 3.5 years to file a refund. So, and revenue may want to comment on this, but if we don't conform this year, I suppose we could conform a later year, and we would still have the opportunity to file an amended return.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm asking. If we can't get it done this year, if we could make this change next year and these same filers could take advantage of the opportunity. Ms. Von Mosch?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Yes, I believe that would be possible. I think the main restriction with this is that the people who are affected have a timeline in the federal law for them to roll over the money into a traditional IRA. And so they would be doing that without knowing for sure if Minnesota had conformed or not. And the other thing I'd like to point out on the revenue estimate that Senator Daley was talking about is that this is marked preliminary because we are still tracking down how many people will be affected by this. And so this is considered a preliminary estimate. We're continuing to work on this to identify how many taxpayers in Minnesota might be affected by it.
All right, thank you. Other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, just to reiterate, I mentioned it before, I just want to emphasize it in a follow-up. The individual must place the funds, which were taxed as ordinary income, into the IRA by August 13th, 2012.
Senator Daley, we'll do what we can. We'll look for the final revenue note, and that may give you better news, and we might be able to work it in. We'll do what we can. All right, without objection. Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Dibble.
So just to be clear, Madam Chair, what Senator Daley just described in terms of the deadline to place those funds into the Roth, that wouldn't change even if we did this retroactive conformity. Didn't happen this year. That deadline still has to hold.
Senator Dibble, that was my understanding of what we were just advised.
Great.
And
thanks.
Maybe
uh-huh.
The revenue note can address that as well when they turn it into a final. Hopefully we'll get a final piece of advice on that from the Department of Revenue. So without objection, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion. Senate file 2427, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Senator Peterson is here with the TIF District for St. Cloud Economic Development Authority. Senator Peterson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today we have Senate File 2437 before you, which relates to a TIF district that we have in for the city of St. Cloud. There's a little bit of confusion surrounding it in terms of some legal interpretation that we have, which is why we're here. We need to have some clarification in state law. There's really two parts of this bill that's quite short. The first part just deals with the ratification of the district, and second, we need to clarify that we want to spend those dollars that are left on infrastructure within that same district. This confusion goes back to quite some years ago. We have a TIF district from 1976 as well as 1982, and this uncertainty has been created because of, I think, just of the pure age of these districts. And I have some guests here to testify in favor of this. First, we have the director of our Economic Development Authority in the city of St. Cloud is Ms. Kathy Mihalich, and then Michael Williams is the city administrator from the city of St. Cloud.
Thank you. Ms. Mihalich, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, just want to provide a little bit of background about why we're here today, and thank you for hearing us. The city of St. Cloud discovered that we have a cash balance on a very old gap year TIF district. This is a redevelopment district that is no longer collecting increment. I want to clarify that. All of the increment today is going to city, county, and school district. However, there is a cash balance that exists after the obligations were just recently paid off, and these funds would otherwise be available under the jobs bill. to stimulate private development. And while there's a lot of development opportunity in St. Cloud, none of them fit within the time frame under the jobs bill. And so the city has determined that a better way to utilize those funds is to, and the balance is $712,000, by the way, we've determined a better way to utilize those funds would be into public infrastructure improvements in the downtown area that would help stimulate that private development that we expect to occur anyway. Again, that would support that anticipated development. We're seeing some high technology companies who have some desire in expanding in our downtown area. We just anticipate it's going to be in the next 3 to 5 years. We want to make the downtown area a very vital and healthy area and safe area with these improvements. In addition, as Senator Peterson mentioned, the ratification is necessary because of the age of the district and the complexity around the pre-79 and the gap year districts. Even though the city was operating it in our best intent for, as a gap year district, at the same time there are certain complexities within the law that could make it a pre-79. So we would like authorization number one to expend that balance on public infrastructure improvements in the downtown, and number two to expend them within the 3-year time frame.
Ms. Mihalich, question: the excess TIF funds, when you say you want to use them in the downtown area, is that within the TIF district?
Correct.
Thank you. And you also have Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the issue's been adequately covered, and if there's questions that I can help answer, I will do that.
All right, are there questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. What can you do with it if this doesn't pass? Is it just sitting there?
Yeah. Ms. Mihalich.
Madam Chair, committee members, in response to that question, if we cannot use it under the jobs bill, it would be required to be redistributed back to the county and school district. And we have had discussions with the administrators with regards to our intentions.
Ms. Mihalich, any opposition from the county or the school district?
The county is certainly supportive. They are the largest employer in the downtown area, and they recognize the improvements will benefit their employees and the vitality of the downtown in which they exist.
Questions or comments for Senator Peterson or the testifier? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is probably fine. The only concern I have, and it goes to comments that Senator Bach made, it sounds like the rationale for spending these dollars is to facilitate economic development, but then I'm hearing that economic development, that expansion is happening anyways, so the but-for test doesn't quite get met in this regard. I mean, I understand the need for public improvements, and I support that, but try to be kind of discipline when we talk about using increment from tax increment finance districts to pass that but-for test. I don't think that necessarily that threshold is quite met in this case, because it sounds like this activity is going to occur anyways.
Senator Dibble, I agree with you, and especially about the discipline when it comes to TIF. This case might be a little bit different because we're not talking about the original reason for developing the TIF. That was for economic development that otherwise would not have occurred, and now there are excess increment funds, and the question is what to do with the excess increment funds now that the TIF is being decertified, and they want to use them in furtherance of the TIF district and development within that district. And I think under these circumstances, to me it looks a little differently. Maybe it doesn't look to you any differently, but I think that's different than saying we're going to form a TIF for purposes of economic development that would otherwise occur. Senator Dibble.
I will say, Madam Chair, this kind of reminds me of the conversation around doing some of the transit-oriented development types of development in terms of guiding the quality and public realm and the type of development we want. For example, along Central Corridor, which is, of course, going to achieve and realize fairly significant economic development, but the qualitative question becomes what type of development and what do we want the public realm to look like. In that case, I'm very supportive and not nearly so disciplined as trying to meet that but-for test. So that's what we're talking about. I'm enthusiastic.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, is the school district
they're aware of this, obviously. Do they have any strong feelings one way or another?
We've had communication with the school district superintendent at this point, not with the board.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that was a point I was going to make that Senator Pardee made. Senator Peterson, I would be very supportive of this, but I would like to get something, you know, from either the school board and possibly the county, some sort of a letter saying that they're okay with this, because it does affect. Anytime we make changes, it's a redistribution to the other taxpayers in a district, and they need to be, whether they know or not, obviously, even if they don't agree with it, you can still come forward with this this idea, and we can make that decision. But I'd like to hear something a little bit more than I just talked to the superintendent. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, I would agree with you. One of the reasons why I'm confident in bringing this forward is that because on the school district's legislative priorities, actually from the city of St. Cloud this year, they wanted me to carry legislation that would exempt them from having to forgive anything altogether in regards to economic development, because they of the opinion, they believe that they're there to educate children and not be participate in economic activities, so to speak, on behalf of the city and the county. And so we've had similar discussions in the past, and I think you know, we can talk to them about that and try and get that for you. The only other thing I'd add, Madam Chair, of course, is that I think we're all well aware of what's going on in urban cores of larger cities across this entire state. And that's exactly what's happening in the city of St. Cloud. We have an urban core in this district. These dollars will go to help shore up and rebuild an aging infrastructure that we believe will simply attract more visitors to an urban core that fights every day for every single shopper and every single job that we have in downtown St. Cloud. So,
Senator Peterson, I'm supportive of your proposal. I'm not sure whether I was asking council if we had done any other excess TIF revenues this year, and we're not aware that we have, but it has been done in the past, and we can check and see. But I think that's pretty standard for the closeout of our TIFs, is to either redirect those TIFs to another project within the TIF district, which is what's being proposed here, or decertify the TIF and send the money back. But they've got a good proposal here. They've got the support, according to Senator Peterson. And as I said, I think it's important that this money is going back into the TIF district. So you have my support, Senator Peterson. Other questions or comments? Without objection, the chair would lay over Senate File 2437.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Senator Senjum is here. Senate File 1881. And Senate File 1881, members, extends the sunset on the historic tax credit. Senator Senjum, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is, I believe and hope, a relatively simple bill. It talks about extending the historic tax credit from 2015 to 2022, and also to extend the reporting requirement by the Minnesota Historical Society relative to the economic impact of this credit to 2025. And just maybe a side comment, I will have to admit, a couple of years ago, and I think it was Senator Pogemiller brought this bill forward, I was a little skeptical about it, but I've since learned that this particular credit has been pretty effective in terms of initiating development and rehabilitation of historic structures. And so when first approached along the lines of carrying this some months ago now, I tended to become a little bit more excited about it, in fact, excited, and wanted to bring this bill forward for the committee's consideration. So with that, we haven't rehearsed this. Bonnie McDonald's going to pick this up and take it forward from those comments.
Thank you. Ms. McDonald, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Senjum. My name is Bonnie McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to encouraging the preservation and adaptive reuse of our historic resources. And I'm also here as a representative of the Building Jobs Coalition. And we've worked side by side with many of you for 11 years to pass the State Historic Tax Credit. And we're so excited that became law in 2010 as part of the job creation bill that was signed by Governor Pawlenty. I would like to thank Senator Senjum for his support then and now for introducing Senate File 1881. In brief, this bill extends the sunset that was put into the original bill for an additional 6 years. This allows for more job-creating construction projects to begin their planning work now, and then to give private investors the certainty that they need to continue the construction pipeline. The State Historic Tax Credit Program has achieved our high estimates for job creation, due in part to its efficiency. The credit parallels an existing federal credit that has been in existence for 35 years. Now, both programs use the same standards and are administered by the same office, the State Historic Preservation Office. You'll find information in the black folder that we gave you about the job creation numbers, the economic development potential, and what it's created in the cities that have tax credit programs, and how it operates as well. This program is bringing federal dollars to Minnesota and giving our state a competitive advantage over our neighbors. Now, prior to its passage, Minnesota had maybe 2 to 4 federal tax credit projects in any single year. Now, since 2010, we've had 27. At the time when the construction industry in Minnesota is still struggling with high unemployment, you'll see the Star Tribune article that recognizes, quote, this is one of the top sources of construction industry jobs in the last few years. We urge you to extend this program to the end of fiscal year 2021 to continue the construction pipeline. Give us additional time in this program so that it can continue to create jobs, stimulate private investment in underutilized properties, and improve the local tax base by preserving our community's most unique historic assets. Thank you.
Senator Senjum, you also have Mr. Kelleher from the Historic Society.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill, and thank you to Senator Senjum for bringing it forward for your consideration. When the legislature passed the Historic Preservation Tax Credit within the Jobs Bill in 2010, you asked us at the Minnesota Historical Society to do an economic impact study to measure the benefits of the Historic Preservation Tax Credit. We turned to the experts at the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality. They're the folks who do this kind of work on a day-to-day basis. So you have a copy of that report in your folder. It looks like this, and it was delivered to you in November of 2011. In brief, and there's an executive summary on page 2 of the report, the study examined projects that were in the pipeline as of June 30th of 2011. So this is a snapshot in time. At that point, there were 14 projects in the pipeline, and there are even more, as Bonnie said, there are 27 in the pipeline at various stages of development. Again, on page 2 of the report, the executive summary highlights the economic impacts of this program. Of those 14 projects that were in the pipeline as of June of 2011, they will have an economic impact of $343 million in direct spending. When you translate that into jobs, that means 1,808 construction jobs. When you include indirect benefits and induced benefits, and there are definitions in the report of those terms, the total economic impact is $451 million with total job creation of 2,948 jobs. Of this total, $152 million is labor income. By way of comparison, before this law passed, there were far fewer projects taking advantage of the federal credit. As Bonnie mentioned, an average of 4 projects in each federal fiscal year, with the most recent federal fiscal year, 2010, there was 1 project that had its Part 2 review completed. So there's been a huge jump in projects that have gotten started as a result of this. As you look for legislation that will create jobs, extending the sunset of this program provides a means of a proven incentive with an infrastructure in place that will continue to create good construction jobs across Minnesota. This will give developers of these projects the confidence to get started on the projects, to do the planning that is required for conducting the projects a couple of years out, with the first wave being architects and engineers, with the hard hat jobs continuing a few years behind that. Madam Chair, we would be happy to answer any questions. We have another witness to come up, but again, thanks for the consideration of this request.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Mr. Moody?
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Paul Moody. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and also a partner of Faribault Woolen Mill Company, and I appreciate the opportunity to share how the tax credit has benefited us. We have submitted an application for registration on the National Register, and we hope to there's a hearing on March 27th at the State Historic Preservation Board, where we hope to get approval and then sent on to the federal government. But we're very very optimistic of that, of receiving the historic designation. Just want to give you a little brief history, a quick brief history of the mill, and then how the tax credit was meaningful to us in our process. The Faribault Woolen Mill Company began in 1865 in Faribault on a Straight River, and after several fires, they moved to the current location in 1892. And it has been at that location and in production all the way through 2009, when unfortunately, due to some economic and business reasons, it had to close its doors. And during that time, from 1892 to present, it grew to a building of over 175,000 square feet, and it grew over that time due to the growth of the business. And at one point, it's been reported that this mill produced half of the woolen blankets sold in the United States. And during World War One and Two, the odds are if you were a soldier, you had a Faribault blanket in your backpack. So this mill has a long storied history, and has been a significant part of Minnesota's history. There's been generations of families as well that have worked for the mill. At this point, we have employees that have 25 to 50 years of experience with the mill. While I don't have records to validate this, the mill employed in excess of over 150 people during its peak time. As I mentioned, in July of 2009, the mill closed its doors after 143 years of operations due to, again, as I mentioned, a variety of business and economic factors. And it was March 8th, a year ago, when I walked into the mill for the first time for a visit. It was a cold day, and I found a building that was very, very tired, very large, and it was left exactly the way it was on a Thursday in 2009 when it closed. There was raw wool going into carding machines. There was half-loom blankets coming out of the looms. The desks looked as though the people pushed their chairs back and left and didn't come back. There had also been a 500-year flood in 2010, leaving 10 feet of water in the basement. Now, while the water had receded, what was left in that building was it was dirty. It was cold. There was no running water. There was no heat, and there was limited electrical power. And so for my cousin and I that were taking a look at this opportunity, we didn't have a great deal of time due to a variety of other factors not important here, but we had to make a fairly quick decision. But the building was a key component to our decision-making and whether or not to take on this venture. It was important that the mill be at the mill site where it had been for 143 years. So we had little idea what was the cost would be to renovate this place and get it back in production. We were aware of both the state and federal tax credits, which were significant in our decision making, in that we knew that we were going to be making a significant investment, and the credits both state and federal, were ones that, you know, really, I don't want to say it put us over the top in our decision making, but the significance of the credits were very important in marshaling our capital in the most effective ways. I mean, there's ways to, we had both operations and a facility, but without the facility, the business model didn't work. And so we were very, and I will say this too, we did have to make a decision on the tax credit before we knew we had to, make our decision on the business before we knew we had historic designation, because of course we don't get the tax credit unless we have historic designation, but we felt, at least it was my view, that if this wasn't a historic site, I'm not sure what was. So
Mr. Moody, excuse me, can you answer a question for Senator
sure.
Michelle?
Please.
Madam Chair, I don't have a question for Mr. Moody, but I have strong respect and regard for what he and his family are doing, so I just wanted to acknowledge that at the end of his testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Moody, if Thanks. You could get to the part about the tax credits.
Yeah, and I want to say what we've done here is from last July to present, we've engaged plumbers, electricians, carpenters, painters, roofers, architects, engineers, and a variety of other contractors in the rehabilitation of the mill. And I'd say, you know, at peak times, we've had 25 to 30 people there every day, and probably on average at least 10 to 15 workers working on this facility. And to this day, they continue on a number of significant projects we're doing to rehabilitate the building, where we'll hopefully come to close on a good deal of that very shortly. But we've also purchased equipment such as boilers, other significant pieces of equipment for the building, which were, you know, created jobs as well. And as we go forward and operate this mill, we will continue to employ, and I should add, too, that most of these contractors were local contractors, and we'll continue to employ those folks as we move forward in the maintenance of the building. And then I just like to, you know, so I can wrap up here, we currently have about 40 employees. We're in the process of hiring 30 to 40 more employees. We just received a large contract with a large retailer, which will turn us into a two-shift facility very quickly. So what I want to emphasize is that the tax credits were very meaningful to us in getting this building and this project underway, and something that has allowed us to make the improvements we need to bring this business back to life. And so I appreciate, I think this has been great legislation, and I certainly endorse the extension of the sunset.
Thank you, Mr. Moody. Question, Senator Bach.
Mr. Kelleher, I remember very well when we passed this. We repealed the low-income fuel credit in order to free up some money in tough budget times to fund this credit, the angel investor credit, and then an expansion of the research and development credit. What I don't remember is how did we divide the money up? Did we put about $10 million into this, or what was the number? And has the demand used up all the money, or is it outstripped the appropriation, or where are we at with the money that was appropriated relative to projects that are in the pipeline?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Senator Buck, I think that the historic credit program has had a startup phase, so the amount of money that's been spent in the first fiscal year or two has not been, the approximate price tag is between $10 and $15 million per year. Again, in the first year or two, it's been a little slower than that, but I think it'll ramp up a little bit in the next couple of years. So that gives you a sense of approximately how much is being spent during the first few years of this.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Kelleher, if we didn't use all the money in this biennium, is it then available in the next biennium if the demand is more than what the appropriation was?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Senator Buck, my understanding of how this works is there's a credit and a grant in lieu of credit, and on the grant in lieu of credit side, that's a sort of open and standing appropriation, and then on the credit side, it's however those work with the Department of Revenue, so that the dollars are available. There's not a set amount that's there to be spent or not spent. So it just depends on the demand.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Senjan, for bringing this forward. I did want to acknowledge Mr. Moody
And the Faribault Woolen Mill, this is a great story. And my hat is off to you for you and your family for taking a risk in tough economic times and for doing it here in Minnesota. So the combination of the history and reopening this plant and then what your family has been about, we just really appreciate it. So thank you, Mr. Moody, for being here and for speaking up for this bill.
Well, I thank you. And I would just add, which I should have, is you know, we have other staging components of this project. So the extension of the bill would be helpful to us as we move forward. We are not going to get everything done right now. So knowing that it will extend out would be helpful to us, and knowing that that we could accomplish a few other things with the facility.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Kelleher. Perhaps you covered this. I had to step out for a second. But on the National Register on page 7, you have a list of where some of the projects have been. And I know you have Mr. Moody here from Faribault, but how are the dollars being split between Greater Minnesota? You know how I always get on that. I want to make sure that there's proper representation and a fairness, because on this list, it looks Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis County, Duluth. So.
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you're right. The first wave of projects have been concentrated in the metro area in Duluth. We've been working really hard to get the word out. We did Deeds Roadshow to travel with them to explain the historic credit program, and we would love to see more and more projects across the state. So we're trying to get the word out. If you can help us get the word out in all of your communities that this is available, that would be great.
So Madam Chair and Mr. Kelleher, are applications coming in, and what is the timeline on that? Are you seeing a pretty good spread across the state of communities applying for this?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we'd like to see more in Greater Minnesota, but it depends on the projects coming forward to apply for the credit. It's, you know, self-initiated. We need to get the word out to get some of the projects in Greater Minnesota going.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Carroll, how do you get the word out? I mean, this is through Deed. Is that correct?
We've worked with Deed, our partners in the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the advocacy organization, has a field services program. They talk to communities across the state. Looks like Bonnie wants to add something.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I just wanted to let you know, I just looked at the list of the projects, the 27 projects that are in the pipeline. There are an increasing number that are coming from Greater Minnesota. So the first 14 that you see in this report are highly invested in our urban areas, including Duluth. But we're starting to see smaller projects in Main Street communities right now, and I'd be happy to share that list with you. So there are an increasing number. That Deed Roadshow did help to promote the tax credit in some smaller communities as well. Not only in Faribault, but we're seeing some starting to come from other parts of the state, including our Main Street communities that we run out of the Preservation Alliance in Minnesota.
And members, a little bit more information for you. Ms. McQuay advises that the tax credit is an open and standing appropriation. So fiscal year 12, it'll be $9.8 million. Fiscal year 13, projected at $17.4 million. Fiscal year 14 at $9.1 million, and fiscal year 15, $21.1 million, and this legislation extends it beyond 2015. Senator Skoy and then Senator Dibble.
Senator Skoy. Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe to Mr. Kelleher. And Mr. Moody might have answered my question, because he did talk about that it would give him some certainty to have this extension. But you are extending this outside of the time frame of the current revenue note. Is there any practical reason to not, I mean, that this has to be done this year for these businesses, or is it just a convenient timing issue, or what's the rationale for going from 2016 to 2021?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I think the reason is to give folks like Mr. Moody notice that this will be available. So these projects take a few years to plan. There's complicated architectural work, historic preservation architectural work that has to be done. There's a ramp-up period to do that. So 2015 is just around the corner, so giving folks time to prepare and know that this will be there. I think also that if there is a sunset, there could potentially be a rush to get projects in before that deadline. So having an extension may smooth out the cost to the state a little bit rather than having a sharp cutoff in the availability of these dollars.
And Senator Skoy, I've learned for sure that when they do the projections, it's based on current law. And so if there's a current law sunset, the projections stop at that point. And so if we're trying to send the signal that we want this to continue, it makes a lot of sense to lift the sunset so that we don't have a current law cliff like Mr. Kelleher is talking about. So I think it makes sense if it's our intention to move forward with this tax credit. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think this conversation just answered my question. The question was, we don't cap this credit. It's just available to whomever.
It is, Senator Dibble.
Whoever applies and is qualified. So it's a curious artifact of how we handle some credits by capping them, kind of first come, first serve, or we do some sort of a competitive process, and others we just kind of make available to anyone and everyone.
You know, that's an interesting question.
I always
question.
Try to sort out, you know, whenever we're considering a new credit, the decision to cap it or not, I just always try to figure out kind of the policy imperative to do that or not.
Senator Dibble, I think there are very few that are capped, but that might be a really good question for the Department of Revenue to just advise us as to how many of our credits currently in law are capped. I don't know. It's a good question. Other questions or comments? Well, Senator Senjum, this is a good bill, and it's a good segue into the next bill, which is the clarification of the language on the credits and the grants and certificates. And Senator Senjum, I don't see any objections, so I'd like to lay over for a possible inclusion, Senate File 1881. Thank you, Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
And members, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Michelle for a hearing on Senate File 2449. And Mr. Chair and members, I think this will go pretty quickly because I think we had a really good introduction into the historic tax credit. But Senate File 2449 is a very good complement to the bill that we just heard for Senator Senjum. What this does is clarify for the lawyers and all those that are trying to do all the paperwork related to these tax credits, it will clarify how to manage what are certificate programs for the grants and the credits. And we have folks here that will testify in support of that, and I'd like to start, if we could, Mr. Chair, with Mr. Peterson from Winthrop and Weinstein.
Very good, Senator Ortman. So, Mr. Peterson, if you'd join us at the table, and there's enough chairs there if you've got anyone else with you. I don't know if Mr. Hansen's a part of this, but if you'd just identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the Tax Committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. My name is John Peterson. I'm with Winthrop and Weinstein, and I'm here on behalf of Sand Companies and MNB Development, which is a developer of a 12-story Renaissance Revival office building in downtown St. Paul. We're here to discuss a proposed amendment to the Minnesota State Historic Tax Credit for really two purposes, one of which is to clarify certain terms in the statute that practitioners such as myself have found ambiguous and difficult to work with, and to make the statute more consistent with the federal statute upon which it essentially is piggybacked. The second purpose of the meeting here is to clarify certain ambiguous provisions in the statute that are not in the statute currently, and to make the statute more user-friendly to people like myself and to people like Mr. Moody, who just testified. The first... just running through the proposed amendments, the first set of amendments really deal with the consistency to the federal statute. The statute provides a 20% historic tax credit in the same amount and to the same extent that the federal historic tax credit is also available. There are some differences between the federal and state statute, but the definitions used in the federal statute are essentially the same type of definitions used in the state statute. And those definitions are not incorporated in the statute currently. So we have proposed to add those definitions so that practitioners understand how the statute is to be applied. The second set of amendments that we're proposing are the clarification of ambiguous provisions. The first area that we would like to propose a change would be to allow a taxpayer a mechanism to challenge an adverse decision of the State Historic Preservation Office in the issuance or or denial of an allocation certificate or credit certificate. There currently is no mechanism for a taxpayer to challenge this type of a decision, and we would propose that the taxpayer be allowed an ability to challenge a decision as a contested case hearing under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. The second area in which we're seeking clarification on ambiguous provisions is concerning the assignability of the credit. Currently, a taxpayer is allowed to assign the credit, but the statute doesn't identify how the credit is assigned. We've seen both, not only in Minnesota, but in other states such as Missouri and other states that have an assignable credit, that the assignability of the credit is very important in maximizing the value of the credit and producing the greatest amount of dollars to the project for which it's intended to benefit. The proposed assignment provisions clarify that the credit can be assigned to multiple transferees and can be assigned more than once, up to three times. The amendment also clarifies that the credit can be allocated to owners of any entity in accordance with any agreement that is signed among them. In speaking briefly with the Department of Revenue, we understand that they have some concerns with the assignability, and we're confident that we can work with them both in the statute and in regulatory provisions to address any concerns that they might have. The last area in which we're seeking clarification of ambiguity concerns the language on which projects qualified for the credit when the credit was enacted. When enacted, the effective date provision provided that the statute applied to structures for which qualified costs of rehabilitation were first paid under construction contracts entered into after May 1st, 2010. The problem with this language is that there are a number of projects, well, I should say one project in particular, that had qualified costs paid under a prior owner. And it was curious whether the project would qualify or not. We are identifying, we're seeking to clarify that the credit applies to projects which are completed after May 1st, 2010 to eliminate any controversies with the State Historic Preservation Office and to clarify the effective date provisions of the statute.
So Mr. Hansen or Mr. Bagnoli, do you have some testimony for us this morning on this bill? Mr. Bagnoli.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of clients in my law firm that have used the historic tax credit and continue to use it. In fact, there's a project in Senator Dibble's area district that we're using it for, and another one in downtown Minneapolis, two historic structures that but for this is a little bit to testify in the last one, but for this credit wouldn't be going forward. As to the assignability issue that was just discussed, this has proven to be an issue that has caused a fair amount of difficulty in trying to navigate through that. It is a standard procedure with the federal tax credit and in the other states that use this to have it be readily assignable the way that the proposed bill does it. So we would support on behalf of the couple of entities that we represent that you adopt this. We're here just to support this bill today. This conforms to what is done basically in business throughout the country where these historic tax credits exist. That's
it. Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Mr. Hansen.
Just a few quick comments, Mr. Chair. We are working with the Department of Revenue as well as the Historical Society to iron out any changes in this bill. But from the 50,000-foot level, this is an example. I know everybody's looking for ways to put people to work. With a few simple changes to this statute, we can put more people to work on these projects, and that's all we're trying to do today. And that's it.
Mr. Kelleher, a bit of an echo from the previous bill, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, for the record, it's David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. And I just want to say for the record that we have some concerns with the language of the bill as introduced. We've had conversations with Mr. Peterson and folks from the Department of Revenue. We want to make sure we get this right, particularly with the effective date. There's some gray area. The intent when you all passed this bill 2 years ago was to find the right language to catch the projects that hadn't really already started so that projects that were underway weren't getting a free lunch. It was projects that were using this incentive that wouldn't have happened otherwise. By using the term placed in service, we're doing a little more analysis. You may catch some other projects that were underway previously using the federal tax credit, and we want to make sure that we're not catching those and, again, get the language right. On the assignability question, the Department of Revenue obviously was mentioned, has some concerns about making sure that the integrity of the credit certificates that are issued as part of this process don't mushroom and get out of control. We'll continue the conversations and make sure that we get this right as we go through the process. So we would appreciate some additional time as this bill travels and its parent bill travels through the process to make sure we get this right.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the testimony from Mr. Kelleher and also from the proponents. I know that the department is here to testify. There is a revenue note for this, and I think that speaks to the effective date because the revenue note says that there is a $7.6 million cost in 2013, which is, in my view, insurmountable. I think it's going to be very hard to do this year with that size of revenue note, given some of the goals of the committee. But we are going to roll out the bill tomorrow, and I think that should give you guys the provocation to work on this, because that might be the last bill out with any kind of revenue impact. There will be a policy technical bill later, but that won't have any revenue impact one whatsoever. So given the timeline, my encouragement is that you all work on this as swiftly as possible to work that revenue note down and to iron out the differences. And, Mr. Chair, I hope, in addition, we can hear from Ms. Von Wash.
I've got two members with questions, I think, for this panel. So before revenue comes up, Senator Dibble and then Senator Lemmer. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Kelleher, if you have any reaction to the ability to challenge decisions by the Society or by the Historic Preservation Office as a contested case, lines 2.33 and 2.34.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we would acknowledge that the way the bill was passed in 2010 does not contain any kind of appeal process or anything like that. So I think we would like to see that language tightened up a little bit. And, again, we've had the initial conversation about that, and we just need to finalize the language. But there's not an appeal process. We just want to make sure it's limited to the issues that are within this section of law. There are other processes for example, putting a property on the National Register that's outside of just the State Historic Preservation Office. That gets into the National Park Service, the Department of the Interior, and we want to make sure that we don't wade into those processes, which do have their own appeal processes in place on a federal level.
Senator Dibble.
I will note, typically property owners fight historic designation. This is kind of an interesting turnabout on this subject.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I bring your attention to page 3, lines 13? This is in regarding credit certificates. And in the proposed language, it says that the recipient may assign the credit certificate in whole or part to other taxpayers. Is the word may assign, is that kind of a legal way to say that they can sell that for a remuneration to someone that may be able to take advantage of it in a different manner?
Yes.
And is that a taxable event when someone pays for it, so the recipient of the cash, is that a taxable event?
Senator Lemmer, we work very hard to have that not be a taxable event, which is why we're seeking the ability to assign it more than once.
All right. I was hoping you'd say that. The other question is going down to line 22. Now, in this case, it's not the recipient of a credit certificate. It's a recipient of a grant. and the recipient of the grant may assign a grant to another. Now, isn't there some qualifications of someone receiving a grant that you have to qualify to get a grant, and does that qualification follow to the other person that may be assigned?
Mr. Peterson.
Senator Limmer, can I ask, when you're asking about the qualification to assign or to receive a grant, are you asking from a state law perspective or from a federal income tax perspective?
Well, I don't know if it necessarily needs to be defined or separated that way. I'm just thinking someone's going to get a grant in the first place. They've either jumped through hoops, they've qualified, they're whoever it is that gets the little checkoffs off on the qualifying standard. But now that that's been accomplished, it looks like you can now take that grant and then sell it off to somebody else. Does that someone else have to qualify as well? Or are they under the first recipient of the grant's qualifications?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think the way to think of qualification is more in the project itself. And these are historic preservation projects that have to follow historic preservation standards and guidelines. So if the project itself follows those guidelines, in our eyes, it doesn't really matter who the end recipient of that is, as long as it's within the project, within the partnership doing the project. So qualify really means the project itself.
So, Mr. Chair, in this case, the grant stays with the property. Is that what you're saying? It can't be passed on or assigned to another party, and then they use it on another property. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it could be assigned if it's within the ownership of the property, and the ownership models take many, many different forms, and Mr. Peterson is more expert in those than I am, but it's within a partnership that owns the property.
One other question on lines 3, I think on page 2, and on lines 4, you have a retroactivity for taxable years beginning in 2009. Why are we applying this retroactively?
Mr. Kelleher or Mr. Peterson, who wants it? Mr. Peterson.
Senator Limmer, the reason why we're clarifying the effective date language is because there is some controversy on as to one particular project in particular that the taxpayer believes qualifies for the credit as of a matter of right, and the State Historic Preservation Office has not agreed with the taxpayer. So it would eliminate a controversy with the state.
Ms. Von Mosch, if I could ask you to come to the table and maybe briefly, because we want to honor, I know Commissioner Franz is here, and you want to honor him too.
Yes, I do.
By getting to his testimony on another bill.
Mr. Chair, members, I will be very brief, and I have two main things I want to emphasize in that we did issue on March 12th of this year Revenue Notice 12-06, which did articulate the position on the assignability of the credits within existing language. And I won't go into the details on that, but we did provide, as a department, we did provide clarification of that assignability.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ortman, to that.
I'm sorry, is then that revenue note consistent with the proposal that we have from these folks?
Ms. Von Mosch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, no, this proposal would render that revenue note obsolete. Then, because the way the current language is written and the way the revenue notice was written, it basically allows for one assignment.
I see.
It does allow for some flow through to pass through entities, but it is one assignment, basically. And then just very briefly, our main concern with the language in the current proposal is the fact that it allows the credits to be assigned in whole or in part up to three times without the consent of the commissioner, We had been working with the Historical Society to develop a tracking system for keeping track of the transfer of the credits, and we're concerned that with this type of language, which is so open and it allows multiple transfers without the consent of the commissioner, that we would lose track and we would be really not able to track who really is a rightful owner of one of the credits. And when they come in to be claimed, we're concerned that perhaps there might be more credits claimed than are really available to be claimed. It is an administrative issue. We can work with the authors of the bill to see if we can come to some common understanding, and working with both the Historical Society and the authors to try to get something worked out. But we are concerned about that ability to track, to know who is a rightful owner of a transferred, an assigned credit.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I would say that there is room for some negotiating and compromise here, and I think we could probably work something out between all the interested parties, and it will be my effort to lead that conversation and hopefully work out something that everyone can be supportive of before we would include it in an omnibus bill.
So, members, then we will, without objection, lay over Senate File 2449 for further consideration.
Thank you.
So, members, we do get to hear from Commissioner Franz this morning still. I do want to let you know we have the room until 10:15. And so hopefully he can do his presentation, and then we'll hear from Senators Skoy and Marty, who are carrying portions of the governor's tax proposals. Commissioner Franz, you're always welcome here. Thanks for coming this morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the committee for this opportunity to hear the this bill. I want to thank, first of all, Senator Skoy for introducing the governor's Jobs Now tax credit, and also Senator Marty for introducing the Senate File 2479, which provides for different funding. And if I might just real quick explain the difference in those two bills so that we can get into the jobs credit issue. The first Senate file introduced by Senator Skoy is the Governor's Jobs Now tax credit, and it is funded by both the affiliate nexus provision, and also it's funded by a reduction in the FOC and the foreign royalty payment deductions. It takes those deductions from 80% to 70%, and that's enough to fund the governor's Jobs Now tax credit, which is about $35 million. But in the second bill, in the Senate File 2479, that bill makes two adjustments to the foreign royalty deduction and the FOC deduction, taking them from 80% to 62% in the first year, and then down to 39% deduction in the second year. That change, in addition with the affiliate nexus, is enough to fund both the governor's Jobs Now tax credit and his supplemental budget bill, which has also been introduced in other committees. So it's that combination now of those two bills that fully funds the governor's proposal. What I'd like to do briefly is talk about the governor's Jobs Now tax credit, and then let Senator Skoy and Senator Marty make any other comments. One of the things we had a great discussion in Chair Michelle's Jobs Committee several weeks ago, and I look forward to questions and comments today from members. The governor's main concern, obviously, with this Jobs Now tax credit is to try to increase jobs now. That's why we call it the Jobs Now tax credit. And the priority is to get Minnesotans back to work now. The credit is designed to provide a business with a $3,000 tax credit for 2012 for those new hires in 2012, and a $1,500 tax credit for those new hires in 2013 up until June 30, 2013. But as you all know, this is a very targeted, a very specific, and a limited jobs credit. The idea was this recovery is going slowly, especially with respect to jobs. And by targeting the promotion of jobs now, the governor wanted to promote increasing jobs immediately during this lull in the job creation process. We think it could create as many as 14,000 jobs, and we paid for it, as I mentioned, with the affiliate nexus and also with the reduction in the FOC and the foreign royalty payment deductions. Both of those provisions for payment purposes are designed to level the playing field and make taxes fair for all businesses. The reason that it's so targeted, the governor's job credit is so targeted, it uses three different categories. It uses veterans, it uses unemployed Minnesotans, and recent graduates. Those are the three areas that we thought deserve the most attention now to creating new jobs. And so the governor's jobs now tax credit focuses on those individuals as qualifying employees for the jobs credit. One of the things that we're particularly concerned about are the veterans. As you know, the veterans unemployment rate right now is about 50% higher than the general population. And it's anticipated that the unemployment rate for those men and women returning from the Red Bull combat team this May could be as high as 20%. So we're really concerned about that particular group and all veterans and also unemployed Minnesotans and recent graduates. We've limited the tax credit to $50,000 per business in order to spread the tax credit out as much as we can across the state. We've also made sure that there'll be an application process online to make this a very smooth process, one that the Department of Revenue can monitor fairly easily without a lot of expense. The tentative credit applications would be up and running within a month or so of after passing the tax credit. Just going back real quick to the unemployed Minnesotans, we have about 168,000 Minnesotans that are currently looking for employment. There's a handout showing the some jobs numbers. I think we handed that out the last time I was here, but maybe we didn't get a chance to talk about it. But the handout shows, the two charts show that when we lose economic steam and we lose jobs, that the income tax receipts, the sales tax receipts, and the corporate income tax receipts all go down. For example, in 2004 to 2008, we had a 4.7% increase in the number of jobs, but we saw a nice, robust increase in the sales tax receipts, the income tax receipts, and the corporate tax receipts. But unfortunately, as we all saw in the recession, where we lost about 5.7% of our jobs, we saw a 9% decrease in sales tax receipts, a 17% decrease in income tax receipts, and a 46% decrease in corporate tax receipts. Clearly, jobs are the key indicator for us to try to work our way through this economic recovery. A number of states have also utilized this same job creation tool. About two-thirds of the states now have some sort of tax incentive for new jobs created. In California, over $75 million has been expended from their new jobs tax credit that's helped put back to work 25,000 Californians. This program was enacted in 2009 and continues to accept applications. In Florida, the Jobs for the Unemployed tax credit program provides incentives to businesses throughout Florida, and they receive a tax credit of $1,000 for every employee hired under this program. They're looking to create 10,000 new jobs in Florida. In Maryland, the Job Creation and Recovery Tax Credit allows qualified employers to get a tax credit of up to $5,000 per employee, up to a maximum of $250,000 per employer. This program was capped at $20 million and has helped to create 4,000 jobs. And finally, in Illinois, they have announced an increase in their Illinois Veterans Tax Credit. They've increased the credit from $1,200 to $5,000 per veteran hired. These are just a few examples of how tax credits around the country have been working to help put veterans and other unemployed folks back to work. I just want to mention one more thing before a few more details about the jobs credit itself. Several economists have remarked about job credits and how important they are to an economic recovery. Economists Timothy Bardick and John Bishop said, and I quote, "The credit should be a key part of the policy mix if for no other reason than that it is especially effective when compared to other tax breaks offered to businesses in the name of job creation. Its effectiveness stems from its straightforward design. Businesses only get the credit if they increase their payrolls, either through adding jobs, adding hours, or raising wages. Its effectiveness also makes its net cost cheap. In short, it belongs in a legislative effort in the near term to create jobs." The Jobs Now credit works very simply. It's a refundable tax credit of $3,000 for each new job during the remaining part of 2012 and $1,500 for those jobs added between January 1 and July 1 of 2013. The employee must be employed continuously for one full year to earn the credit, and the pay must be at least $25,000. We believe the tax credit will encourage 14,000 newly hired employees. And we look forward, the governor looks forward to working with this committee and the chair in working toward a jobs credit that can help put Minnesotans back to work. With that, I'll ask questions, or if Senator Skoy, Senator Marty would like to comment.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me just add a couple things. First of all, for a number of years around here, all of us have been talking about how, in order to get Minnesota's economy back on track, we need to increase the number of Minnesotans that are working. And the proposal that we're putting forward today would do that by adding 14,000 potential good jobs for Minnesotans to apply for. As Commissioner said, this is a refundable tax credit. It is targeted at unemployed Minnesotans, veterans, and recent graduates, three areas that are particularly been hard hit by the economic downturn. It seems to me that it makes a lot of sense for us as we try to improve the job climate in Minnesota to target people in areas that have particular needs. Commissioner Franz went through the bill fairly well, so I'm not going to talk a lot about it. I just want to add a couple things on the funding mechanism. This bill is paid for. It doesn't add to the deficit. And the mechanisms that we use to pay for it, Madam Chair, I think the first one, you actually carried the bill a number of years ago, the affiliate nexus provision. You know, besides the fact that it does raise some money for Minnesota to spend toward this credit to help get Minnesotans back to work, it has the added advantage of helping our Minnesota Main Street businesses compete with the internet marketers. I mean, these businesses are in our hometowns. They're paying property tax. They're in hiring people. And it puts them on a more level playing field with marketers that are don't have bricks and mortar. And the other area with regard to the foreign operating corporations, you know, as we've gone toward 100% sales apportionment for the taxes paid by these businesses and moved away from the formula that we used to have that include property and personnel as part of their income tax calculation, the foreign operating corporation provisions have become less and less important to them because of the 100% sales apportionment. And so we feel it's appropriate to make the changes in that area, too, and it does provide revenue for us to use to fund this job credit and add hopefully 14,000 Minnesotans on the payroll. And, you know, as we are experiencing economic growth, it's not as much as we would like, and we think if we're able to pass this bill, it will help strengthen Minnesota's economy. And so I'd look for positive action by this committee.
Thank you, Senator Skoy.
And Madam Chair, my bill does not have the jobs credit, and mine is to provide the funding for the supplemental budget. It does not include, though I certainly support, the affiliate nexus provision. And mine would take the FOC and the foreign royalty subtraction from the current 80% down to 62% the first year and 39% in following years, which is, in effect, it's just a change in the amount from what Senator Skoy's bill has on that. And again, I believe that this is a fair way of, I'd say, leveling the playing field, especially now that we move to the sales apportionment for the taxes. So I would urge support for this and for the other provisions there in Senator Skoy's bill.
Thank you, Senator Marty. For members, there is a 2012 Supplemental General Fund Budget Recommendation Sheet, if you saw it. And I would just like to point out that this is not revenue neutral. This is a revenue raiser. So there's a tax increase here, $44 million. And the Jobs Now tax credit, correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner, doesn't get paid out until 2014. So the credit is to incent folks in 2012 and 13, but it's not payable until 2014, correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Okay.
And I appreciate the governor's effort here, Commissioner and Senators, to work on these issues. I'm interested in particular in the jobs credit, but the studies that I've seen from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association and some summaries in the revenue notes that review what's been done in other states is that those jobs credits don't really generate new jobs, that it's the productivity needs and the demand in the marketplace that generates the need for the job, and then an employer will hire them. If that's not the case, then we're giving it to, if that is the case, we're giving a tax credit to an employer that would otherwise hire somebody, and you don't want to give the tax credit to somebody that wouldn't otherwise hire someone. And so, because there's no productivity behind it. And so I'm concerned about that particular provision, Commissioner. And do you want to address that?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you. It's a great concern, and it's one that's there for any kind of a job creation or tax credit. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to target it so specifically to certain individuals, and I think that's why this is a little bit different than some of the other states where we've really focused on three different categories, the veterans, the unemployed Minnesotans, and the students. By focusing on those categories, we more focus the credit, and also by limiting it. We think we limit the credit during a time frame that's really critical. But one of the things, you're exactly right, it's consumers are the ones out there who create demand. When consumers start buying, they create demand, and then businesses respond by hiring or making more product. We couldn't agree more with you. And this is not designed to create jobs. This is designed to create the opportunity for employers, if they're thinking about making that job decision, if they're close to making that job decision, this will help them make it now rather than wait. So as a small business owner, one of the things we looked at were those opportunities like this. If there was a $3,000 job credit for a particular hire and you're thinking about hiring someone, this is the thing that can make the difference now. And I think that's the critical component. Is 2012 and the first half of 2013. So your concerns are legitimate, and that's why we've tried to target and focus the credit.
Yeah, and Commissioner, the fact that it's payable in 2014, though, doesn't really suggest that there's an immediate benefit to the employer that might do it. And the fact that it's so limited in its period of application to just 2 years also doesn't suggest to the employer that this is a long-term policy of the state of Minnesota. It's a short-term fix or Band-Aid. And so I'm not sure it accomplishes all that the governor wants to accomplish with this. And more fundamentally, for me, in my view of what's been happening with the economy, what we really need is economic activity. That the job comes after the economic activity is generated, and that's what we should be trying to stimulate is the economic activity, not just the hiring. It should be hiring for a purpose. But that may be just a very different philosophical view of what our approach should be. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, no, and one of the things I think it's important to remember, this is just one part of the governor's jobs program. The first part is the bonding bill. The second part is the Viking Stadium, and this is the third part to supplement that. But you're right. We need to look at overall economic activity to increase. And one of the reasons we've designed a tentative tax credit application process is so that an employer can make an application for the credit, reserve the credit, and know right away that as long as that person stays employed for a year, they'll qualify for the credit.
And to that point, Senator Scoy?
Yes, to the point of the credit. And, Madam Chair, you know, as we've gone through this recovery, you've heard the discussion that this really was a jobless recovery. There's a lot of there was economic activity, but the number of jobs created weren't to the level that we wanted. That's part of the reason that we're hoping this will only have to be a two-year program, because we're hoping that the economy picks up enough where this won't be necessary. But as you try to expand the customer base, customers got to have jobs and they have to have income. So we're targeting these three groups of people that are particularly hard hit by the unemployment in the state so that they will get a job and become a customer and produce economic activity. And that manner, recognizing that businesses do need customers. But also, as the economy has gone through this kind of jobless thing, this might be the trigger that would get the company to hire. That's what the hope is.
Senator Skoy, I appreciate that. I mean, I think we're getting into this conversation in such a meaningful way. But I'm concerned that the economic activity driven by consumer purchases isn't the same kind of qualitative economic activity that we need. When we've had that jobless recovery, it's been productive jobs that have been lost, and we have to innovate. We have to get higher skills. We have to take to the next level of technological ability in order to fill that gap, not just necessarily a job. And if you don't have one, you want any kind of job. I understand that. But I think we should be looking at what kind of economic activity we're stimulating. In my view, it's not all equal. Senator Howe, and then Senator Hoffman, did you want to? No, Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I've just got a couple of points here maybe a couple of suggestions. You know, we heard a lot of talk about small business and Minnesota Main Street. And, you know, the way that this is proposed is it's $50,000, which equivalates to 16 FTEs or 32 part-time positions. And, you know, I don't see that, you know, if you're going to have somebody that's going to hire 16 full-time employees, that this is quite what's going to drive it. You know, I think this is going to be geared towards the small business person who's going to add one or two employees, maybe three. And I would think that you would limit this cap instead of at $50,000 to $15,000, because that would be five full-time equivalents or 10 part-time people. And because I do think that it will be the small business person who's going to look at this and say, I can afford to put this on. If somebody's looking at adding 10 people, they're not going to look towards this credit. If they're looking at adding one or two positions, they will look towards this credit. The other thing, the other suggestion I have is on page 3, when you talk about a qualified unemployed graduate, and at line 3.27, you know, again, speaking to the chair's narrow application of this, if I'm a small business person, I'm looking for a recent graduate. Well, now you've got in here that the person has to graduate in 2011. So we're talking that they would have had to graduate in that 1 year. And so we're not going to talk about, I would think you'd have 2001 or after, because we're going to have a lot of graduates coming online here in the next couple of months. And as a small business person looking at this again, I would say recent graduate. I understand you're looking towards an unemployed graduate who's been out there looking, but I don't think you want to take anything away from somebody who's newly looking for work. And also, from a business standpoint, the application of it, that I think having that narrow view, I think you'd have to expand that and say 2011 or after. Thank you.
Senator Howe, I think those are good suggestions. I would also point out the fact that it's going to be hard for an employer who does this to fill out the paperwork to verify the conditions for the tax credit, in particular, you know, who's been employed or unemployed, not had a full-time job after receiving or being awarded the degree. I mean, I think there are some qualifications here, and you're talking about an employer who's applying for the tax credit after the hire. And so I think there are some complications that if you want to continue, you'll want to look at. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I think both of Senator Howe's suggestions are important, because I don't think what you want to have the thing that somebody just this year or later gets. I mean, it's not going to be that much longer, but 2012 certainly. And I think this is the type of thing, because of the simplicity of it, you're more likely to see the small business do it. I don't think you're going to have somebody coming in saying, I'm going to hire 16 people. They might take advantages if they were anyway, but I think the biggest impact is on the small, very small businesses. And I think that whether that cap is too high, I don't know, but I think the place you're going to see the impact is in smaller employers.
Commissioner, I would suggest, I'm not a really big fan of the jobs tax credit. I've told you that before, and I've done my best to articulate some of the reasons. But I would ask you as an alternative to look at the capital upfront equipment exemption. The capital upfront equipment exemption. The studies that I've seen show that when businesses invest in new capital, they're just as likely to invest in new jobs, because they're buying new equipment, they're upgrading their technology, they're making an investment in their business, and perhaps there's new skills needed and new employees needed. That may be another way to get at this issue, but I think we're all trying to accomplish the same thing. None of us wants to see 168,000 Minnesotans unemployed. We're all trying to accomplish the same thing, which is to generate economic activity and get folks back to work and into a way of providing even more economic activity and growth in Minnesota. Other questions or comments? Commissioner, final
Madam
comments.
Madam Chair, no, thank you. All your comments are well taken. We appreciate the feedback and the comments. And I think the concern was for this particular situation, as Senator Scoy has mentioned, is the uniqueness of this recovery and the lack of jobs in this recovery and trying to target this thing as much as we can to particular folks who really need it in a short order. And we do want it, the small business owner, to be able to read the newspaper and go, yes, I qualify, or no, I don't. We want to try to keep it as simple as possible so that they can get this and they can make a move pretty quick. But we do have to have a few little safeguards in there, such as the application and then the one-year wait to make sure that the person is hired for a year. But we understand your concerns, but I think the governor's really been concerned about making sure that any kind of a credit for jobs requires a job to actually be part of the credit.
Commissioner, members, we had available to testify who will come later, Jill Larson from the Business Partnership and Tom Hesse from the Minnesota Chamber. We'll have them before us when we have our bill up tomorrow or Thursday. And we can also have some updates from Ms. Pollack at that point on the court cases related to the affiliate nexus. And just so you know, we have introduced a resolution to Congress on the Marketplace Equity Act, which is where I think that we should be heading when it comes to the affiliate nexus, as maybe a federal solution there. But we'll consider more testimony. I know Senator Marty and Scoy will be actively engaged in this conversation as we proceed through the week. Just a schedule update, members, tomorrow from 8:30 to 10. We have committee, and we'll have the omnibus jobs bill at that point. We'll take some public testimony. We may add Senate File 2321, which is the transportation omnibus policy bill. I understand that that's not controversial, but that's what I hear. You never know until you see the bill in front of you. And then Thursday we'll have additional public testimony, amendments, and hopefully passage of the omnibus jobs bill. We'll have hearings from 8 to 10:30, and then we will meet again in the evening if we don't accomplish all of our goals on Thursday by 10:30 a.m. During the week of March 26th, we're going to hear the non-budget bills like the local sales taxes and some other technical bills. So
Madam Chair, we're not meeting on Friday then.
I'm hoping we won't be meeting on Friday, that we will complete our business on Thursday. Commissioner, thank you so much for being here, and Senator Scoy and Marty for your presentation. We are adjourned.